Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode 4, and this week we're discussing the bias of gear reviews, how gear reviews and Freakit actually work, Instagram's new AI flagging software, the changes in social media, and how social media is changing the way the photography industry works at the moment for marketing, because it's kind of gone full circle. We're going to talk about educating clients, how long we keep client raw files for, the latest Mac OS update, which is joyously fun, the team that we work with over here, our favorite beers, and my new studio, which you'll see soon. Back again with Rob.
Howdy.
And this will be, we'll try and make sure it makes sense for audio only, but it's video over on YouTube, and then on all the other podcast services, it's audio only. So there was a video done, I don't know if you've seen this, Rob, but by Gerald Undone about the bias of gear reviews.
Yes, yeah, I actually like Gerald because he's an Uber nerd like myself.
He is. He's very, very methodical. I watched one of his videos once on batteries and just decided that I don't need that information in my life. But I do like him as a presenter, as a person. He's like a really cool dude. But it was very interesting. And the general consensus, and I think this is a consensus that the general population of non-YouTubers have as well, is that if you're doing a gear review and you're being flown off to some tropical island to review it by the company, then you have a bias. And I have mixed opinions on this. I don't fully agree with what was stated. But the general consensus is if you're being given free kit, you will have a bias towards that kit. Is that what you'd assume?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a broad blanket statement, and things generally are a bit more nuanced than that in the real world. However, I do tend to agree with that for the most part. So there's the initial, you're being flown off to a tropical island by, you know, a couple of brands are quite famous. You do this on the regular, do almost like an annual summer camp.
Yep.
Where you get where the, you know, they invite a bunch of, you know, YouTubers and tech reviewers to basically test drive their new gear, you know, for a week and sort of wine them, dine them and all this kind of stuff. So just the experience of that is, does sort of paint a rosy glow in your heart because it's quite a nice thing. I mean, I've been taken to Los Angeles by a rather well-known American brand of audio, and that was a great trip. But I'm not the biggest fan of the kit.
Yeah,
but you remember that trip with very, very fondness. So, and as such, everything you tend to talk about as a result of that trip tends to be positive. So it has that spin from that kind of emotional connection on just from yourself before you do anything else. And then there is a certain expectation, you know, when you actually come to talk about or review the kit afterwards, it's, I can't really be mean about it because they were nice and they took to this lovely island and we had nice dinners. And, you know, so you have that kind of sort of weighing on you. So I guess there's a bit of emotional pressure from the brand initially, just from that.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with the latter part there, in that if a brand, I mean, I know that there's certain brands that won't give me camera equipment anymore because of things I've said about them. So obviously they don't get a positive review from me because they couldn't, because they won't let me review their products. But there is definitely an onus that if they send you something, you've got to say something nice about it. And the way that it works for YouTubers is a brand will reach out to you and say, we've got this new product. We'd like to gift you one of these products in exchange for a review. Now, we all know what's going on here is they're saying you can have this for free if you say something nice about it. Obviously, there's no legal requirement to say something nice. You can say whatever you want, which is what I do, which is why they don't send stuff anymore. And then there's the other side of thing, which is sponsorship, which is when they pay you to make a sponsored section about a product, which is not a review at all. It's an advert, much like the YouTube adverts, but this is built in. So for those who don't know, YouTube pay you peanuts. I've got videos that have got nearly 200,000 views that made me about £200. And it's a very low amount of money. Now, the flip side to things, and this is the bit which I don't think many people know about free gear on YouTube. Say, for example, Broncolor gave me £30,000 of lighting equipment. I then have a tax bill that I have to pay because that is classed as payment in kind. And you are taxed on the value of the items. It goes onto your gross. It goes towards all of your taxes. And it's not free kit. And yes, sometimes if you're going to buy it anyway, it's cheaper to be given it. But if you had no intention of buying it, it is certainly not cheaper to be given it. Likewise, I get asked by brands all the time to go to expos and things. It is, they might pay for my travel and my hotel, but it's going to cost me one entire day's work plus another day to catch up on that. So that's 2 days' work, which is not worth it. it's going to cost me tax of payment in kind and anything they give me. So it would, even if they put me up in like the fanciest hotel and took me somewhere, it would still end up costing me more money normally than the product would cost itself. Unless they're going to give me like a £50,000 camera, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, with high ticket value items, it's certainly better to be given it and have to pay the tax on it than to buy it and claim the tax back.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. There's a
pendulum swings in your favour for sure.
But only if you need the item. So what happened to me at one point was I got sent so much free stuff, which is lovely, that I had to sell it all because the tax bill was going to be too high and I didn't need any of it.
Yeah.
Which is a pain. So it's creating work for me because I've not got to eBay at all, which is, you know, obviously I made a little bit of money doing that. Not a great amount though. And the time it took up, I made less money than if I'd have just done my usual work.
Exactly. That, you know, and time has a value.
Exactly. Like to make it, if I went and did all, one of these big days away and made say £200 on a YouTube video, I'd be several thousand pounds down.
Yeah.
So I don't think I don't think people realize how much it costs to produce a YouTube video like that, which is why I don't do them partly. And the other part is that nothing I have to say about camera kit is of any interest to 99% of photographers because they don't want to know my qualms with the placement of the USB port. They want to know about pixel density and stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Although, to be honest, I mean, all of that you can read in a spec sheet. You know, as I say, the thing that the reviews I tend to look at, and I don't look at that many, but the ones I tend to enjoy or the ones I find personally the most useful are where people explain what it's like to actually live with this piece of kit. Like one of my biggest bugbears, I mean, you know, I've been an Apple Mac man since, you know, 2008. You know, I've been the great convert from the PC master race. And then they might come out the Magic Mouse. Now, Apple, the one thing you can normally say about Apple, value for money, questionable. Reliability, generally good. And then they make the Magic Mouse where you can't charge it unless you plug the thing into the bottom and you can't use it while you plug it. Of all the people who made that design faux pas, Apple, really?
That's like my Sony camera where you can't have a tripod plate on it and change the battery and memory card.
Yeah.
I had to buy a cage just to be able to access the battery. So nobody ever checks these things. But it's like, if you want to see a camera review the day the camera comes out on one of these big trips, it's the equivalent of going to a camera shop to look at a camera. It's pointless because any camera that you use in a camera shop will work flawlessly because there's nothing you're going to do in a 1 hour window in a camera shop that's going to show you a major fault. It's not until you're 6 hours into a shoot and you realize there's a problem with the buffer or that you realize there's a problem that when the camera goes off and on again, it resets certain settings like Fuji does, which is absolutely infuriating. Yeah. But you don't get that from a YouTube review and you don't get that from going to a camera shop. You get that from speaking to, I normally speak to Digitex about which cameras I should get. And they always tell me don't buy Fuji, which is exactly what I went and did anyway, because it's the best bang for buck. But, you know, they will go, these are the problems we have with these cameras. And one of the reasons I stuck with the 5DS system for so long is because it's absolutely bulletproof. There are no faults. It just works. Tethering works. Batteries work. Bus power works. And the files are decent, I think. But
yeah, it's a fair comment. And, you know, there's so much like that. You know, I mean, you might as well just watch their own pre-prepared advert.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything you need to know in 30 seconds. You know, you can sit there and read, you know, the specs at your own leisure, because it's the same. Or most of them actually do, and you know, you actually do see people with a piece of paper literally throwing those photos, reading straight off the press release from Canon. Oh, but look, well, why do I need you to read that when I can just read that myself?
I mean, obviously, it's not something I'm interested in, as you know. My knowledge of equipment is quite limited, but yeah, I can't imagine. I don't know. Anyway, that was the thing. It was about the bias of reviews, but I think, like with anything, if you're looking at a review, you have to review the reviewer. Like, yes. I wouldn't take what most YouTubers say about a camera as gospel because they don't use it like I do. But if I speak to a Digitech and they're like, yeah, this is an issue, I would pretty much take what they say as gospel. Because.
And also the thing to consider is every review they put out positive? If that's the case, their reviews probably aren't overly useful.
Yeah.
If they are happy to give bad reviews and explain why it's this particular product on a certain day is bad, then maybe there's you know, it's a more watchable channel, a more useful channel.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? I mean, there's also, and then you also have your own personal bias, which you form over many years for all the reasons mentioned. Like, I personally am a big fan of Canon stills cameras, because I've used them, you know, from day one. And in, you know, 10, well, 11 years now, I've had to replace one shutter and one camera. They work. They just keep on trucking, man.
Apart from the shutters.
Apart from the shutter. That's and again, it's the one thing I had to replace. And likewise, you know, in the video world, I shoot on Blackmagic. And I've got on great with it. And yes, there are quirks. You know, I have two cameras. Both of them have little problems, not the same problem. So you have to you have to remember, you know, what camera you need for certain things, because one doesn't work on the DC port and one, you know, and so on. But in terms of, again, bang per buck, much like you chose the Fuji, in terms of image quality for the money, they're unbeatable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are some, you can get better image quality than the Fuji. You could get a P65 back. But it uses that like 9-pin FireWire tether cable, and that's just a nightmare. But yeah, I think the Fuji is the best usability, image quality stills camera available. I can't think of anything better. There was a Leica that was quite good, but it has some sort of like problem where the CCD rots.
Yeah.
Also some weird rust formation. But yeah. Anyway, that's camera reviews in a nutshell. They're pretty pointless. The only time they're of use is if someone reviews it having owned it for several years. But it's like buying a new car. You don't know if it's a good one or not because it's new.
Yeah.
It's not until 10 years later when they're still all on the road. Yeah, 3,000.
There is an infancy niggle. If nothing's gone wrong in 6 months, it probably won't.
Exactly. We should probably shoehorn this into the Mac OS update. Because I've been seeing people on Instagram furious talking about waiting 6 months. So for those Mac users or PC, I'm sure it's a similar thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rob.
Well, if I was asked once upon a time to explain the fundamental difference between PCs and Macs. And to do this very, very quickly, if you have a problem with your PC, and many people do on a daily basis, you Google, my PC does this, and there'll be someone saying, oh yeah, mine does that, and this is how you fix it. Brilliant. With Macs, and I say, I've been on Macs now for, you know, since 2008, you type in, my Mac does this. You get nothing but forums saying, yeah, mine does that as well.
Yeah.
And not a single reply of how to fix it. So, you know, there is that. When they go wrong, they tend to go biblically wrong.
Yeah. And the problem seems to be that, so Mac updates the OS, and then once they've done that, everybody else has to then update their software to work with the new OS. So let's move my mic a smidge. There we go. I can face a bit. There we go. Nice bit of a turbulent sound. So when Mac update their OS, you should never, ever, ever, ever update it, because nothing will work with it. All the camera drivers don't work with it. All the software like Capture One won't work. Lightroom won't work. Anything like that will not work with it. You do not update it until all the Digitechs in the industry say, it's now safe to do so. So I follow LS Digi on Instagram, who everyone should follow, because he's a genius. And he's also the person who makes all my like tether woes go away. Until he says, good to go, don't update it. Turn auto updates off. Just wait, because they'll tell you when it's time.
I mean, obviously as a long time Mac user, this has always been a thing. Now, the general safe spot you can say is when they launch the new OS, that's when it's time to install the last one.
Yeah.
And they'll still do a few little updates here and there, mostly security updates in fairness. But by that point, that particular operating system, which would be Ventura as of today, yeah, is fully mature and everything has now been dialed in and works. Sonomo, when it was on like, you know, whatever, 0.3, no. You've got to wait till at least 0.7 and whatever the next one will be, which they'll announce later in the year. When that one drops, then it's safe to install Sonomo. Yeah. You can pretty much figure out that everything has been fixed.
Yeah,
that is going to be fixed.
And
this is something else. And the other thing is as well, it's the problem with Macs, unless you have, anyone that has a Mac, please immediately buy a hard drive and use it for Time Machine backups.
Yeah.
Make sure you can completely clone your entire machine, because once you upgrade to it, it won't let you downgrade to the previous one. You install Sonomo, and as you've discovered on the world wide webs, everyone's getting massively triggered because a whole bunch of stuff doesn't work. How do you step back from that? Well, you have to wipe your computer, wipe the hard drive, and do a fresh install of Ventura again.
Yeah.
So, Time Machine is one of the most amazing things about the whole Mac.
It's a very good system, isn't it? Time Machine. I quite like it.
You know, you buy a new Mac, you know, restore from backup because your old one died and you can't recover the data from it. Just instantly back like that, all your passwords, all your software, everything, including software that you've upgraded over the years where the software still runs, but the installer won't now work on the latest version.
Yeah.
So Time Machine is brilliant for a whole bunch of reasons. So you should do that. But yes, I would always recommend that you wait at least 12 months until the new version that they're going to be moving on with of the operating system drops, and then it's safe to install the last one. If you stick to that as a rule of thumb, generally speaking, you'll have no problems.
Yeah, and it's the same with software as well. Like, don't install the latest Photoshop as soon as it comes out.
At least you can backstep with that.
You can, yeah, but it's still just time and effort.
It is a bit of an issue. And as well, don't install the beta apps unless you like fiddling with these things, because it always sets everything to default. You say, why is it now opening the beta app? Because it decided it wanted to.
And... Yeah, I had that issue inside of Photoshop.
Yes, I had to wind it down. So.
Yeah, it's quite. Had to fix me, didn't you? I guess that is one of the questions we had is actually sort of slightly related to, this is a very strenuous segue, but keeping client files, talking about using the, I've seen all, doing one-to-ones with people, I've seen all sorts of horrific backup systems where people think they're backing up and they're not actually backing up, they're just keeping it on a hard drive, which is just the only copy. So my general rule of thumb is have it on two separate physical locations and on a cloud. So in terms of, I'll answer the question first of all, how long do I keep the client files for? I have every photograph I've ever taken, ever. Which equates to about 65 terabytes of photographs. It's a lot. I'm trying to cut down on how much I keep and now deleting frames during shoots, which I didn't used to do. I've got loads of useless photographs. You don't need to do that at all. You just need to keep the finals, really. But I've kept everything. And they all go onto a drive. They go onto a drive which we tether to, and both of those go to independent Backblaze accounts, which are very good. And that's how we back it up, and we just keep it forever. I know for a fact that some of the files don't work anymore, despite the fact they're backed up. The backups are corrupt. But I haven't got the time to go through them all. So keep adding to the mess.
And again, and why would you? Why would you visit something, you know, knowing that it's dead? And it's a very unlikely thing. Now, I work a bit differently in that, I mean, you actually switched me onto Backblaze.
I'm not endorsed by Backblaze at all. I pay them money. They should endorse me.
We both actually pay Backblaze money. So it's a great system. Check it out. I tend to keep, while the project's live, I work much the same as you. The drive that the project was shot on is quarantined. I've taken the footage off that onto another drive on the computer, which is now the working file, both of which... are now on two drives, and both of those are backed up in Backblaze. So there's two cloud copies plus two physical copies in existence. And they say those drives are quarantined until such time as the project is delivered and I've got sign off from the client. Then what I tend to keep is only the delivered files.
Yeah.
For example, especially when you're doing sort of video centric things, you know, you basically back up everything that's on the timeline that you've used and the client signed off. All the other hundreds of files that you've got that you haven't used, straight in the bin because they were never used anyway. And why would I want to keep a copy of stuff that was never used in the first place?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we just keep B-roll video footage.
That's different because we keep coming back to that to dip into it. Because, it'd be useful for this little montage that we're now doing and something's changing. You need some new content for a new adventure that you're doing. And there's some B-roll that we shot before, we'll do that. And I think most creators would do that, we'll keep hold of B-roll. But in terms of client work, you wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, like today we're shooting, obviously, podcasts. I'm working on one of my workshops today and we're doing YouTube videos. So I'll probably shoot 2 terabytes by the end of the day. Yeah. And that's just not sustainable.
No, I mean, and again, trying to keep that backed up in the clouds, you know, you need your own server farm, you know.
Pretty much.
So it just makes no sense to keep anything that isn't live and continually useful for me.
Exactly. Like once these podcasts go live, the footage is of no use to anybody, so we just bin it. But for some reason, my stills, I keep everything, even the bad frames.
Yeah, but I think it's a bit of nostalgia there for you as well.
I don't have a look at them though. I should probably look into that really. And I mean, I guess again, a bit of a weird leap here, but talking about keeping client files. One of the questions, and do pop questions in the comments below or send them in to me because we do add them to this, was talk about what you need to educate clients on. So there's a real thing in photography, or I feel there is, where people get annoyed at clients for basically being clients. They get annoyed at them for all these things they do, and they're like, oh, they should know. Like, we had a client recently who wanted all the raw files. They've licensed 6 images. They can use 6 images. They've got 1.5 terabytes of raw files. Now, I could educate them that they don't need them, that I have them for them. I could educate them that they're not retouched. I could educate them that they can't use them anyway. But why bother? Is my, like, I tend not to educate clients because they do not want educating. I can advise them, and I often go, look, this is how I do it. And if they say no, okay, not a problem. The drawbacks to this method will be this, this, and this. Are you happy to proceed? You know, like, if they want to have a slightly bad time because they won't listen, that's up to them. It's not my job to educate them.
I mean, you're, in terms of, I mean, in education is not a word. I mean, advise. Do you remember during the pandemic, follow the guidance?
Yes.
That tends to happen. I mean, obviously, I've been on set with you numerous times. It's more about, in terms of creating the image, what's practical. And that's where the client does need a bit of a steer in some occasions.
Yes. I would never say that I educate them as such, because I think a lot of people think you should, like, teach them why they should pay usage. And I just go, look, you can have them to use them for everything. That's going to be £150,000. Or if you just want to use them for this billboard for these 3 months, it's 20 grand. Which one would you like? And they can make it. It's very rare that you're going to educate a client on anything. You can advise them. You can tell them how you'd like to do it, and they can agree or disagree, and you can choose to work with them or not. The worst thing I see photographers do is trying to educate clients on photography. Like, they give a shit.
No, they literally don't care. Again, it's like so many things, you know, that the implausibly posh waiter.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the one, it's, you know, you just want to go and have dinner. You don't want to have someone stand there for 30 minutes telling you how every nuance of that dish was made.
Exactly.
Unless you ask the waiter.
Exactly.
This was delicious. How was this made? Could you tell me every nuance and how everything the chef did? It's the same principle.
Yeah. And I think, like, I mean, the industry is changing a lot at the moment. There seems to be a lot of inexperience on the client side for some reason. There's like a whole new generation of people have suddenly come in from nowhere. They quite literally don't have a clue.
Well, I mean, dare I say it, post-pandemic, remember all the adverts, retraining to something new.
Yeah, well, maybe it was that. But there's definitely been like, we've had briefs come in and we've put in like reasonable estimates, often below 6 figures, and they've come back and gone, we've got £2,000. And it's like, well, you can't even get me at my day rate without any usage or anything else on top turn up for that. Like, I can come in for a meeting.
Yeah, but I mean, again, it depends on who these sort of people are. I mean, as you work your way up the ladder in anything, I mean, if you take photography itself or, you know, content creation, I suppose, with the modern term, because obviously, you know, everything now has to have moving pictures. You know, you start off, you know, you're happy if you've got 80 quid for a gig and, you know, you're absolutely, you know, gassed.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that's about what I got for my first job. Maybe even, I don't know, I got 30 quid, I think. Covering someone.
But you were like, mate, I got paid, you know, and you're super happy about it. And then, you know, as you get better, you start to sort of push your wages up, and that goes on and goes on. And the same things, if you're at the level of, say, you're getting paid, I don't know, £150 a day as a photographer, and then they've asked you, oh, could you bring in a videographer to come in with it? And someone said, oh, Rob, got this job. Great, cool. How much are you? And this much. They're like, well, that's more than I'm getting paid. I'm not, I know, but this is what these things cost.
Yeah.
This is the, again, but because they haven't, got to that point in their career yet where they're in that echelon where that becomes the normal amount of money paid for things. So it's one of those, if you don't know, then you just don't know. It depends where you are at the time. And this could be, again, like ad agencies that you deal with a lot. You know, a lot of these are like some fresh young kids, you know, sort of straight out of university. Right, we're going to start an ad agency. What do we pay for them? I don't know, a couple of grand. And then they go fishing and realise that's not the going rate for collection work at all. And then they have to have a bit of a rethink. So for sure, you're going to come across that.
It definitely seems to be quite prominent at the moment. We've had quite, or at least I've had like an influx of just complete time wasting. You know, or like I get sent the brief after doing some work. You know, it's my own fault. I should just tell them. I can normally tell at the start. There was one recently where they're like, how much would you charge to do something like this? And I was like, well, it would be somewhere around this ballpark figure here. They're like, brilliant, that's perfect, that's within budget. Super. Can you send me the creative over? Send me the creative over. It was black and white film photography for documentary work. And I was like, oh, is that the wrong brief? And they're like, no, that's what we want. We liked your macro fruit photography. Can you do this? And I was like, no. This is not what I do. So they'd looked at my work, seen what I do, saw they had a brief for something completely different, and went, this guy, I don't know what the thought process was, but...
No, I mean, that does happen surprisingly often, actually. It's just, you know, people look at your body of work, and they're like, oh, everything I like here is good. I mean, your photography is a bit different if you just look at your website, because it's obviously you keep everything very current and very up-to-date, yeah, kind of where you're at the time. I mean, there was a time where your website was full of nothing but film shot,
yeah,
large format, you know, film photography, and yeah, portraiture. And now those days are gone. You know, it's now full of very bold graphic, food photography. So if they just like what you do, and it's like, this guy's good, you know, we really like this guy's style, so I'm sure he can do everything, right?
Yeah, that must have been their thought process. But I mean, it was a big agency. Yeah. They should have known better. Like, it shouldn't have got to that point. And then they were annoyed at me for saying no. And I was like, I don't even have a camera I can hold in my hand. Oh, well, I do, but like, I'm not taking it. I don't know. What can you do? There's definitely a change.
I mean, it's definitely a compliment from that point of view, that they, you know, they like your work. And that, first and foremost, that's the point. Now, again, rule of thumb, if you're looking for a specific, and, you know, you've always been very upfront about, find your niche.
Yeah.
You know, if you want the you know, the art buyers and creative directors to find you and know you're the guy for that job, it's find someone who does that specific style.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So again, if you're looking for, you know, dark, moody, you know, gothic images, you're probably not the first choice on the list.
No, exactly. Yeah, I don't know how I ended up on that part. And the thing that annoyed me the most is he phoned my phone number. And I hate people phoning me when they don't need to. Like, I don't mind, I like having phone calls. I chat on the phone all day pretty much. But when people phone me, when it could have been an email that I could have dealt with at a more convenient time,
yeah,
and then it was a complete waste of time anyway. It's like, you just had 45 minutes of my life for something I'm never going to do.
Especially a busy man with a pup and a family.
I know.
Time's precious.
Time is fleeting. There is not enough time at the moment. We're having some real workload issues, which don't seem to be outsourceable. And which are, there's a couple of directions which go in here for our next topic, but I think probably the new studio, because one of the big time constraints at the moment is my new studio, which is behind the wall at the back of my studio. So where the big colourful colouramas are, behind that is the same space again. But for the last 7 years, it's been occupied by my mate Matt and his many trinkets.
Defunct PA gear, yeah, actually, in fairness. So, you know.
Slightly moody audio gear. But it's all gone. And they've now got a massive empty space coming up. So by the end of probably 2 weeks' time, we'll be ready to start building. And I'm going to paint the walls a nice dark grey. The windows are predominantly blocked out. The floor is going to go a dark grey. The ceiling will stay grey concrete. I've got to get the electricians in. And then it's going to be a rental studio, really. Kind of a rental studio. It's going to be a rental studio to people I know. And for me, it's going to be where I do the bigger set work. Mm. So although it's a big space, it's busy. There's a lot of stuff in here. Whereas next door will be empty. It'll be super clear, super clean.
I won't have a full kitchen, for example.
Won't have a full kitchen. It will have a nice... My granddad passed away years ago when I was like a teenager. And his workbench, which is literally what he spent his entire time on, had to be taken out of the garage to build a bathroom in there for house conversion. And it just so happened that I realised this was happening. So I've now got that workbench. I dismantled it, which took ages, because he built it properly. And then we ferried it in the mumbabeel to the studio. So it's currently waiting back in the new studio space. So we're going to have the old workbench in one corner so I can build sets, create sets, have all my tools there. I still have the tool station here as well. Then I've got a nice church pew that we got hold of, which will go down one wall, which matches the wood of the workbench, coincidentally. And then, yeah, just a nice big shooting space, I think, just to, you know, create some big sets, do more of my portrait work in there, because it's a bit tight in here for portrait work. You can't quite get the lights far enough out with anything else. I still need to get a lens for my Fuji to shoot the portraits. Although I did realise I found my 24-105 zoom lens, and I've still got one Canon 5DS. Yeah, yeah. So I can use my 5DS for portraits with a 24-105 rather than buying any more lenses.
Yeah, what's the by far the better of the two commonly used 24-105? As you know, I've got the Canon version.
Yes,
which is the most boring lens in the world.
gets the job done.
But if you can only take one lens anywhere, that's the one you would take.
Yeah. The thing which annoys me about the Sigma is the zoom's the wrong way around. It's Nikon style zooms.
Yeah, it's the Nikon style, which all of the Sigma lenses are, if you've noticed.
I've only used that one, so yeah.
As you know, I've got a whole plethora of the Sigmas, and they're all like that to the point where now, because I do mostly video work with the Blackmagic cameras or using the Sigma lenses, that now is becomes the norm, and now Canon feels alien when I have to use one of those.
Actually, I've got the same Sigma zoom as you on my video camera.
Yeah.
But it just stays in the white. Well, you
just tend to set and forget. It's not something you use on the rig.
Is it 2.8? Yeah. I don't even know what zoom it is, but it's all the way wide.
And when I'm shooting stills now, I'm almost always shooting with Sigma Primes.
Yeah, I do like Sigma Primes.
So that doesn't bother me either, you know. So that's the...
I've still got that 35 somewhere.
The bigger issue with the Sigma 24-105, which is one of the reasons I've never actually got upgraded to it, is for videography... The focus ring is tiny and right at the back.
Yes, the focus ring is completely defunct.
It's backwards. It's like, why Sigma?
It's an autofocus only lens.
Circling back to what we were saying earlier about living with the real world gear reviews.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so what a great lens. It's much sharper than Canon. Go and buy that. And said, I want to use it for video.
Nah.
Wrong one, dude.
Not for video. So my setup next door will be a 5DSR, a 24-105, and Broncolor lights. And I'll be renting that kit to people as well. People want to use Broncolor kit, because I don't think there's anywhere near here where you can use Broncolor kit. You can come and use my Broncolor kit. If you want to, you know, I won't be renting out my camera for work, but my spare camera, you can get a 50 megapixel camera, good zoom lens.
Great color science.
Broncolor lighting.
Good files, I've retouched them many times.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of that good stuff.
Yeah. So that's the new studio. It's just, I mean, it shouldn't take me too long, should it?
No, now you've actually kind of got rid of the clutter.
Oh, and there's still quite a lot in there. I'll show you later.
But compared to what it was.
Oh, yeah. You can actually move through it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge space.
Yeah. And also, I've got racking shelves on the other side of this wall, so I'm going to put loads of kit on there just to... I might even get rid of the shelving in the office.
Yeah, transfer it sort of out there.
But I don't really need a big...
And then, office. In fairness, what would you do with that space anyway?
Yeah, nothing. Just more desk, isn't it, to put more things on. I'll probably leave it in there because then there's less space to heat up in the office in the winter. I've got to sort out heating for the new studio.
Yes, that's
I'm thinking something. Infrared panels.
That seems to be where the smart money's at.
Yeah, because the electric bills here are astronomical, which is not ideal. And as I've just finished my Fanta Lemon, there was a comment on the last YouTube version of these podcasts about me drinking beer whilst being on a podcast. Now, first of all, it was alcohol-free beer. But it was only alcohol-free beer because that's what was in the fridge. If it was an alcoholic beer in the fridge, I would be drinking it under certain circumstances. One being that I hadn't driven in because I don't have... I think you're allowed, like, in the UK, it's like one drink and you can still drive? It's a bit of ambiguity. I mean,
again, if you have a 4% beer, you can just about get away with one.
Yeah.
But, you know, just don't do it.
Yeah, so, yeah, my ethos is if I'm driving anywhere... Just don't drink. Because, yeah, you know, I don't want to have an accident and be like, well, I wasn't over the limit, but I was close. So I don't drink at all like that. But I think, you know, well, Pete and I, my agent, we're starting a podcast in Soho. I think we're doing it out of Little Italy, which will be absolutely banging. But we will be drinking. There'll be bottles of wine and straws on the table because it's quite a boozy industry, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the whole kind of... When you're talking podcasts in creation, I mean, the world's most expensive podcast, the host is famously rarely sober.
Yep.
I think that's without getting into...
That should keep us legally safe.
Yes. So, you know, and that's the world's biggest, the most expensive podcast. So that's fine. I think the comment was how unprofessional it was. And, you know, I had a little giggle because I'm like, well, I happen to know that's Heineken Zero.
Yeah.
So, you know, if anything, there's probably more damage in me drinking the Fanta Lemon. That was your thing. You said you're both drinking, so you both like drinking beers. I've only been representing Fanta.
Fanta Lemon. Now, if you do want a cheeky good drink to have in the summer, get a glass, fill it with ice, like right to the brim. Put 3 shots of tequila in it and top it up with Fanta Lemon. It is absolutely delicious. You don't need many of them, but they're very good. That is my go-to summer drink. Fanta Lemon and tequila is absolutely blissful. But someone was asking, like, what are our favourite beers and stuff? Now, I have a bit of... on my first big shoot, my first ever big shoot, it was a week-long shoot. And about 3 days in, it was about lunchtime. And my producer came over and went, oh, do you want anything, Scott? You're looking a bit shattered there. That wasn't the word she used. And I went, oh, I could murder a pint. just as a joke. Anyway, a few minutes later, someone had been to the pub and bought me a pint of beer and brought it into the studio. And I was going to sat there with a pint of beer at lunchtime. So it's not unprofessional in our industry at all. It's obviously unprofessional to be hammered and unable to work. But I mean, like, the second we finish a shoot and we say, that's a wrap, which I do enjoy saying, the beers come out. Every shoot, pretty much. Do we ever not have beers?
Well, when you say we... Often you're like, right,
you're still working.
You're like, it's a wrap. Right, get the beers out. Do you want Robin? No, I've still got 7 hours work to do. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm normally hammered by the time you're starting to work.
Yeah, and, like, and most often I've driven here anyway. So
yes,
even on occasions where you told me not to do that, I still generally do.
Yeah, I always get an Uber in for shoots. And we tend to, if I'm shooting, I don't go home. I tend to stay in a hotel, unless it's in Leicester, of course. And my go-to is we finish the shoot, couple of shots of tequila, couple of pints, out for dinner, then out, and then. But then, you know, most of them I don't drink at all at home. I drink loads of alcohol-free beers, which is probably really bad for me because of the sugar content. And because they're alcohol-free, I'm like, I can drink loads of them.
Yeah, you can drink
but community beer. I probably wouldn't drink 6 cans of Coca-Cola, but I would drink 6 cans of alcohol-free beer.
No, I rarely drink at home, almost never. I did drink the Tours Highs you bought for my birthday.
More welcome.
Yeah, they went down well, which is actually probably my favourite beer, actually.
Yeah, I do like an Asahi. I used to work in a bar in Cardiff in 2006, and we got free Asahi at the end of the shift, as much as you could drink. And I've always liked it because of that. And then Qingdao, from when I lived in China.
Yeah.
Drink that out of a carrier bag. But yeah, I mean, I don't drink if the children are at home, because...
Children.
My partner doesn't drink at all, so it's only really on shoot days I drink. But my favourite beers, oddly enough, and this is only in the last few years, if you can find an IPA that's only 2% volume, because at the end of a shoot, I like to literally neck a pint of beer. You don't want to be necking a pint of Stella, but that hits you hard. But a nice 2% beer, which makes me sound very mild and middle-aged, but a nice 2%.
Well, I mean, the Green King IPA,
yeah,
I think 3.2%.
That's a bit much for me.
That's right up there. But that's their session beer, because, again, always popular, along with Ruddles in Witherspoons, because they want you in there drinking pint after pint. They don't want you getting hammered in 3 pints.
Exactly.
You know, they want to keep you for the afternoon, so they call it a good session beer.
But the reason they don't do weak session beers in this country anymore is because they go off too quickly.
Yeah.
Anything below 3% doesn't last for more than a few weeks.
Which is the reason that the IPAs got invented in the first place.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Yeah, I like a low-alcohol beer. There's a beer that you can get in Leicester called Table Beer, which I think is like 1.something%. So it still tastes like real beer, but it's not very alcoholic.
Yeah, I think it has to have some alcohol in it to taste like an actual beer.
Yeah, apart from, you know, Heineken Light does taste like... I mean, Heineken doesn't taste like a great beer in the first place.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So the yardstick is a bit different. It's like having, you know, 0% Carling. Well, it tastes like water anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I'm sure alcohol-free Carling would taste exactly like the genuine 4% product.
Alcohol-free Guinness, on the other hand, you would not know the difference.
No, but that's more down to the roasting of things. And
yeah, research. That's really delicious.
That's where the flavour comes from.
I do like an alcohol-free Guinness. But yeah, that's our drinking preferences. Rare, sporadic, and at speed after a big stressful shoot, because shoots are stressful when there's like over 6 figures a day on the line and you are the sole responsible person for everybody.
Yeah, it's your name on the ticket
getting their paychecks and you not getting sued. It's a lot of stress, and you get this like massive release as soon as it finishes, and then you sort of go a little bit loopy for a little bit, which is, I kind of enjoy it. I like the highs and lows. It keeps it interesting. So I basically drink coffee all day long, get absolutely wired on that, like as pepped up as possible, and then crash and burn.
But we haven't had coffee today, strangely.
Oh, no, I have made some over there. You can see it's in the pot. And it's gone cold. We'll make
it first time ever.
We'll make a fresh pot after this. It's only gone lunchtime. We've still got some time going on. But yeah, the next bit here is about the team that I work with, because a lot of people are like, well, who's involved in these things? And I'm going to make a YouTube video on this today, actually, because... everyone's like, well, how do you manage to be a photographer, be an agent, run workshops, do one-to-ones, do this, do that, and do it? And it's because there's more than one of me. And the way my team works is that it kind of splits in different sections. So I've got me, the photographer, and me, this YouTube stuff. So on the YouTube side of things, it is pretty much just me and you helping out. not exclusively on this, but you help out on the YouTube stuff, obviously being sat here for someone to talk with.
Indeed.
And also editing, setting cameras up, like the other camera's already set up. So once we've done this, we'll just wheel the table out of the way. I won't sit down there and start rapping on whilst Rob edits this and exports it. And because Rob's here to do that, everything's a bit quicker. Like setting up a camera by yourself is quite difficult.
Yeah, just in terms of, can you sit down so I can frame it?
Yeah.
You can't, an empty chair isn't quite the same as someone sat in it.
No, exactly. I often have to put light stands up with a tennis ball on it to try and focus the camera and then sit where the light stand is. But it's other things as well. It's not just that. It's like, normally I'd now have to go through this and it's probably like an hour's worth of editing. Probably not actually. It's just top and tailing this, isn't it really? Great. But it's probably half an hour.
For this one, yeah.
We've not said anything we have to cut out yet, which we're not yet. You know,
still time.
You know, but whilst you're doing that, I can carry on with other stuff. So that helps me there. And I then also have, my girlfriend helps me loads with ideas, because you get to a point where you just run out of ideas, and then she'll say something. I'll be like, oh, now I've got 10 ideas off the back of that thing you've said. So that's very helpful. So that gives me a lot of time there. Now, in the photography world, I get a lot of help. So I have Andy, who is my TV, video, moving image producer and agent. So he markets me for that. He advises me on what to be shooting on test shoots for that and all that good stuff. I then got Pete, who's my agent. And I also work for Pete as an agent. And he helps me with a lot of stuff. He does a lot of marketing on my behalf. And now I'm seeing what they do as well, because I'm doing it too.
And he was a guest on the previous podcast?
He was a guest on the previous podcast. Yeah, it was good. Gave him a phone call, didn't answer. He did phone back though. He said he redeemed himself. But yeah, so like he helps with that. Then Karen does loads for me. Karen's my stills producer and stills agent. And like, we're literally, it's a Saturday and we're messaging her now with edits going, what do you think? You know, she was in Ogilvy for me this week with my book. So rather than me losing a day of my life going to London to go and show my book, I did none of that. She went for me. It's brilliant. So it's like, there's like these scales of economy. So if it was just me, by myself, I could just do the YouTube channel, or I could just do the photography. But because there's lots of people involved, I can do more. And then there's a financial tipping point on each one, where it's like, by doing more, I can afford to pay this much out to increase my capacity. And of course, I can increase my capacity by way more, but then I'll be doing some of the jobs for free.
Yeah, it's also diminishing returns.
Exactly. But it's like, it's little things like, I have an accountant, I have a bookkeeper, I have a cleaner. You know, I don't wash my own car because it takes me ages and I do a bad job. I don't clean the studio because it takes me ages and I'm really bad at cleaning. But all these little things, they like allow me to do more stuff. And then on jobs, most of the team is freelance. So, I mean, I have other people who work here in the week, 9 to 5, as like non-photography workers, I guess, helping me just like build stuff, do stuff. Like
assistants.
Yeah, but not photography assistants. Just like, you know, office assistant, I guess is the way to put it. They come in a few days a week because obviously I need silence as well to do other stuff. But then on shoots, we hire in a freelance crew on every single shoot. Everyone's freelance. I have my preferred assistant, my preferred Digitech, and my preferred editors, but apart from that, if they're not available, we just go with whoever is. It's like,
yeah. It's like anything. You have substitutes for everything, don't you? So
yeah. And then, you know, on a shoot day, I'll often also have my studio assistant in, and they'll be doing something studio related whilst I'm doing this. The only things which I can't outsource are my one-to-ones, because I am physically doing them. There's no cheat code. There's no.
No, and it's one of those. And I've always found this with, say, for example, Joe Bloggs Photography. You book Joe Bloggs and someone else turns up. It's like, you're not Joe Bloggs.
Yeah, I don't think it'd go down very well if someone else turned up from my one-to-one.
No, exactly. So you kind of, you know, you have to represent for those.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do those. What else do I have to? I have to do the shoots. But apart from that, a lot of it can be outsourced, which is good. I like outsourcing. You just have to watch the numbers and make sure you don't end up paying to work.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Pay to play, so to speak.
Yeah. But it's the same in any business, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. It's like, you know, you always said from buying kit, you know, you're much better off buying, you know, 5-year-old Broncolor kit because most of its loss is already taken the hit.
Yeah.
You know, and the function's great and it'll last for another 15 years. So,
every time I tell somebody to buy something second hand because it's cheaper, somebody pipes up in the comments and go, yes, but look, if you buy this brand new and you take the 20% off of VAT and then you take this much off for tax, it's cheaper.
It's not. It just isn't.
It's not, sometimes it is. But and I feel like I have to explain every single like tiny like minutiae details for YouTube. It is sometimes cheaper, but when it is cheaper, it's not devalued enough yet to be worth buying. Like there's a point where like if a brand new camera comes out and there's a second hand one, it's still cheaper as a VAT registered business to buy the brand new one, but you shouldn't be buying it anyway.
Yeah,
you should be buying the previous model second hand. Like, just because there are things where, yes, you can buy, like, cars are a great example of devaluing. Like, you're just losing money, unless you're a car collector and you happen to know what might become popular and you've got storage space. But generally speaking, if you buy a car, you're guaranteed to lose money. If you buy a brand new camera, you're guaranteed to lose money. If you buy a used camera, you're guaranteed to lose money, but at a lesser rate. And it's, I think for sure you can buy secondhand stuff, which is end up costing your business more than the brand new version. But if that is the case, that is not the bit of kit for you.
Yeah, you bought the wrong thing.
You bought something too new, which hasn't devalued enough to be worth buying yet. You know, you get quite a cushy deal on cars. So you're sort of exempt from this. But generally speaking, if you went out and bought a brand new car on finance, you're paying a higher percentage of interest on a devaluing liability. And it's the same in cameras. It's an electrical good. It is going to devalue rapidly. If you bought it on finance, you're paying more interest than you should be. It is devaluing and you're paying more.
Yeah.
It's like the things are just going apart from each other. And the same, like, yeah, sure, you can save VAT and tax by buying it brand new, and you can only save tax by buying it secondhand, not VAT, but just buy a previous version.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at point in case, 5D Mark, I'm going to say 5D Mark III, which I think was one of the best and most usable all-round cameras Canon ever made.
Solid.
And they were, what, $4,000 brand new?
Yeah.
£450 now.
Yeah.
Mate, what a camera for £450. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is my point when I say, like, buy it secondhand, you'll save money. Buy that £450 one. Don't buy whatever the latest camera is secondhand for a small fraction less.
No.
Buy cheap. Because, I mean, I know loads of pros to use 5D Mark IIIs and Mark IVs.
They were great cameras.
Yeah. I don't know many people who've gone to mirrorless and stayed with mirrorless. A lot of them went there and came back again because they had issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have issues with the mirrorless thing, and the RF mount makes sense. And, you know, so there's a lot of positives with mirrorless. I've been using irregularly over the last sort of year or so the EOS R, which is the Canon's first mirrorless. I just can't get on with it, man. There's something about it. A lot of it's probably down to do with the fact it's got an electronic viewfinder that just isn't the same as an optical viewfinder. It just doesn't have the same feel, the same response. It just doesn't feel as usable to me as the 6D does. And the 6D is a dinosaur now by modern standards.
And it's one with the plastic top, isn't it? So it's really light as well.
Yeah, but it's the top bit, because it's got the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi and whatever you all built in. It's the very top bit, they removed the magnesium from that and left it as plastic. So it's I mean, compared to the 5D, it's a notably lighter camera.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Not to say it's super lightweight, but it's light enough. But it just, the EOS R, if anything, because that's you know, full metal jacket and all that, if anything, it's a heavier camera. It's slimmer, but I don't see how that benefits me in any way, shape, or
form. Yes, yeah.
And having stuck a 70 to 200 on it, it feels really unbalanced.
Yeah.
You know, having that bit of heft at the back of it just makes that
I always better. Found you needed a body grip to really enjoy a 70 to 200.
Yeah, I mean, I always shoot with the vertical grips. Always,
yeah,
just because again, you just
looks more pro.
Well, it looks more pro, it does make life easier when you don't. I never like the whole haunching over when you're trying to shoot, you know, in portrait mode. It's just better just to have that button there. And you've got two batteries, so your battery, you know, there's no shoot I can think of that you're going to outlast two of those batteries.
No,
you know, you can shoot easily 2,000-3,000 frames on two batteries. And if you're shooting more than that on a gig, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, the sun has gone bad, but yeah, I don't know. I've gone on a massive tangent now. I can't remember what we're talking about. I was like ranting about people's...
Well, we were talking about the team.
Oh, yes, the team. Yeah, there isn't really a set team. Everyone's freelance, really. I mean, not everyone. There's a couple of people who we don't mention who are on payroll, but they don't get mentioned because they don't want to be mentioned, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
They, you know, it's not everyone's job to be available to the world.
No, and I've been outed now.
Yeah, you're now out.
I'm no longer a dirty little seat. Yeah. I'm now a dirty public seat.
Unchange you from the desk.
Indeed.
Okay, which brings us kind of through to social media. And two elements of social media. One is I've noticed an uptake in work from social media, some of it. And the other, which we'll start with, is Instagram's now flagging images as AI. So if you've used generative fill or something like that, it flags them as AI. Loads of people are up in arms about it because some people have shot film photographs. And I don't know if you know the flat film, but when you scan it, you get dust on it and they use generative fill to get rid of the dust. It's like AI is... I think it's a good thing because it's the deceptive images that definitely need flagging. And if mine gets flagged as AI, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't change my image. I mean, to be honest, even if I've used AI to create my image, I like see nothing wrong with that.
No, and I mean, so there's the purist that's getting a bit angry. So no, it's just been retouched. You know, how is a retouched image any different to AI? If you've used the clone stamp tool, there's an element of AI gone into that. Now, I understand that from the complete generate this entire image of some goddess coming out of a volcano with a dragon in the background, yeah. And they've added nothing to this. The entire thing has been generated by AI. That is a separate category of thing. But at the same time, it looks completely different because it looks completely fake. It
doesn't look like AI.
It doesn't look like a real photograph. You know, it looks like something that's been created. As people would use the term, that's been photoshopped.
Yeah.
You know, which has now become the synonym for everything. But then at the same time, if you've taken, you know, like one of your old, large format stills, and they say had to just remove some dust specks or whatever, that still looks like a real photograph from back in the day shot on film.
Yeah, but what's interesting is I can remove people from a phone, from a film image without using Photoshop, just in paper.
Yeah, yeah, and in the old...
Yeah, I've like masked people out of images. I've like added things into images that weren't really there.
And I think that's things people forget. I mean, the amount of times people have been told, and I've heard it being said, that, oh, it's just so easy now, you just do it all in Photoshop. So what are we doing in Photoshop? Well, you're changing all the colours. Okay, you pick the film stock you wanted for the colour. Okay, yeah. Continue. Well, you know, if you've got your exposure wrong, you just bring it all up. You did that in the darkroom.
Yeah.
And why everyone seems that almost every tool you've got in Photoshop started in the actual analog darkroom.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and again, he sent your film to a certain lab because you liked the way they processed the images.
Yeah, especially with black and white, less so with E6 and C4. I mean, E6 and C41, you sent it to the lab, which you knew wouldn't fuck it because loads of them do. I sent some stuff to a lab in Birmingham a few years ago and it looked like they dragged it across the floor, which is obviously not great. But black and white is really like, even the speed at which you agitate the tank changes the grain structure, the developer you use, the temperature, like there's so much in it which can change it. I don't see there's any issue with this. I do know there's a bit of software now though that you can chuck into your images which stops AI from being able to learn from it.
Right.
I should have discovered what that was before starting this, but someone will let us know in the comments, but there's something you can embed something into your images and then AI can't read it.
Yeah.
So then they can't learn from your images if you're into that. I don't know, life's quite short.
Yeah. And I suppose in terms of the Instagram flagging your image as AI, does it matter?
I don't think so.
To the person, you know, the casual person scrolling down the phone, looking at
just looking at pretty pictures.
Well, this is pretty. Do they actually care if it's AI?
I mean, are they going to go,
well, I don't like this anymore because now I've learned that's AI.
The time I do care is if it's a news article and it flags it up. I'm like, someone's doctored that image. I'm like, that's really good. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting how the press deal with that, to be honest, because obviously, famously, almost every image, unless they tell you it isn't, everything you see in a magazine is retouched.
Yeah.
Every single thing. And, you know, there was the hoo-ha, quite rightly, Kate Winslet got very angry about some images, and she actually made the magazine post the correct images in the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
And issue an apology for retouching her without her permission. She said, I don't look like that. At no point, that's, you know, showing people an unrealistic expectation that that's how you should look.
Yeah.
That's not me. Sort it.
Yeah. Good on her. I think, you know, it's, it's very difficult now to know fact from fiction, like not just in images, but also like in what people are saying. I mean, like I had to learn how to do something in photography recently. And I can't even think what it was. And I know that I watched 3 or 4 videos that were incorrect before I found one that was correct. But of course, like much like this YouTube channel, I can post anything on here and a lot of people assume it's fact.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it might not be.
So much, I mean.
Might be wrong. I'm often wrong.
You know, you've only got to look across the pond, you know, we're in election year in America.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the amount of disinformation that's going to be flowing across social media in the next 6 months. Strap yourselves in.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's no different in photography. There's always, you know, something like that. But what is interesting is that the photographers I represent and myself have all recently started getting work through Instagram.
Hmm.
Proper work, not social media work, like proper clients going, we've got jobs for you from ad agencies. And this wasn't the case for a while. It was kind of a bit dead, but it seems to have come back. And one of the chaps in the Facebook group was saying, why do I always say that Facebook's dead? And we have kind of opposing views on this. Or not opposing views. We have different businesses, I guess is a better way to put it. So on Facebook, the reach is abysmal. If you have a page, as an individual, your reach is just to people you know, unless someone shares it.
Yeah.
Instagram is much broader. Anyone can come in. It's not rude to follow somebody on Instagram, but to friend request somebody you don't really know and just want to spy on a little bit, that's a little bit, it's not the same social etiquette, I guess. So, I mean, I shut down my original Facebook page 6 years ago. My page and my personal page shut them down. I now have one just to run the Tin House Studio Facebook group, which has a whole load of friend requests from people I've not accepted, which I hope they're not being offended by, but I'm just like, I don't want to chat to people on here. So I think Instagram's really good. I also met with a photographer whose entire career is built off TikTok. They had shot something which went viral, and not only did it go viral, it's also good, which is not always the same thing.
No, of course.
And now we're very much in talks with this photographer because they're an interesting person. Their work's good, and we found them on TikTok.
Yeah, and again, it's an easily dismissed platform. You think, well, it's just a bunch of kids doing stupid things and, you know, shot in vertical video. But
it's a lot of kids.
It's by far and away the most...
Yeah,
upwardly mobile social media platform today.
Yeah,
and if you're ignoring it and dismissing it,
then more for you.
Exactly. You know, you're going to be sort of left behind, wondering, you know, why that no one's visiting your MySpace page.
Yeah, yeah.
Topical reference for the kids out there.
Yeah, but on the flip side, you get a lot of work from Facebook.
I do. Yeah, I mean, and again, I think it's task and reward. In that I actually put sort of effort into my Facebook side of things, and you know, I get regular work, you know.
Is it through a page or through a profile?
Well, mostly through my page, but everything that's on my page I share through my personal profile,
right?
And I made the exact mistake you didn't of in the early days when everybody I sort of spoke to and worked with all sent me friend requests. So I've now got like 4,000 or 5,000 friends on my personal profile.
Yeah, that happens on my original one. It's like maxed out at 5,000.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at. So my reach is fairly broad in my for anything that I share on my personal one. And because it tends to work with a lot of sort of, you know, musicians, artists and so on, there's a lot more word of mouth in those areas than there is in, you know, say sort of commercial food photography.
Yeah, absolutely.
So being sort of ever present, you know, does have benefits in, you know, the amount of things you get tagged in and people, oh, such and such mentioned you and so on and so forth. That kind of works for me. And I never really got much from Instagram.
Yeah. I think it depends on where your audience is.
Yes.
Like if I was a family portrait photographer, I'd be up on Facebook. Definitely.
Yeah. And especially now I'm sort of more moving pictures. Facebook isn't really built for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that they're very much trying to sort of push the reels and everything else. But in terms of sort of, you know, showing what I do, you know, and, you know, from a sort of cinematography point of view and filmmaking point of view, it's probably not the correct platform for me.
No, but then.
And then in fairness, I need to put more effort into it.
Yeah.
Give it a solid 3 month push and kind of see what I get back from it, really. So that's a failing on my point as much as anything else.
I mean, I've realized on Instagram recently that I haven't posted in nearly 2 months, but I post on stories every day. Mm. And Teddy's account. Teddy's got his own Instagram account called Retrieving Golden Teddy, which is where I get most of my joy from social media from. Because if I go to the explore page on that, it's just a sea of golden retrievers.
Yes.
But like, yeah, you definitely get out of it what you put into it. But the number of followers also doesn't matter. Because, I mean, like, my entire year can be changed by two people booking me.
And that's always been your mantra, is that you don't want 50,000 followers. You just want the five people, the art buyers and directors from the three big ad agencies.
Exactly,
Happy days, that's all you want.
Yeah. You know, if we've got a couple of people from Ogilvy, Adam and Eve, Saatchi on there, then, you know, we're golden. And then if they're seeing my stories, I'm just refreshing their memory when something comes through that's bold and graphic, hopefully they... You know, they pick me up and I think, you know, I think I got the, I'm trying to think which jobs I got from social media directly. Definitely Johnson & Johnson's. That was social media. That was a big job.
That was a biggie.
Definitely Greg's. GoPuff. That was social media. Pepsi and Doritos. That was social media. And again, not as an influencer, but as a photographer, they then went to my agent and, you know, commissioned me. But yeah, social media is good. Instagram, I think, is good for commercial photographers. But I think if you're working with the public or individuals, then Facebook's probably a pretty good spot for that.
Yeah. And it's what I say, especially in the sort of, you know, the sort of filmmaking world, you know, there's a lot more activity and a lot more groups that I'm involved with than you sort of find on Instagram. Instagram tends to be sort of more broad and, you know, it's kind of almost posting to the whole world.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to work sort of more locally or regionally, then I think Facebook works better for you from that perspective as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. You know, it's horses for courses, isn't it? And I think, you know, I need to get on TikTok, really.
I mean, Teddy for sure.
Teddy for sure. He'd blow up on TikTok. Yeah, I need to be on TikTok because... You know, alongside with all these new people coming in, not really understanding the industry, they're all on TikTok and I need to be there as well. You know, do as I say, not as I do.
Well, yeah, you got to move with the times, you know.
Yeah, maybe we need to get some
ideas. No, I mean, I always said, you know, I mean, I always rejected it initially because, you know, I'm not a 13-year-old girl. But then you've got people like Gordon Ramsay on it and it's like, yeah, it's pretty serious.
It's
on about. So,
yeah,
you know, let's get with it, Scott. Let's get on it.
But I also know really big photographers who don't have any social media presence at all. You know, they just...
Yeah, but then what will happen in 10 years?
No one's going to know who they are.
Correct.
They're in it for now, but they'll be gone soon. But yeah, there we go. Anything to add? Any?
No. In terms of obviously the points we've gone through, I think that's pretty
much... We've covered our itinerary, I think. There's nothing else going on, is there? What have we got on this week? We were supposed to be shooting, but I think we're struggling to get a purchase order number for the shoot. And we're supposed to have a 3-day shoot, so I probably finished my workshop, which I was supposed to do in January. It's now June. It's going well.
It sounds a lot like my decorating at home.
Yes. It's, I'm going to get it done. It's going to be ready to sell by the end of this week. I've almost got it finished. I just want to get a special guest in for it, for a bit of a...
Yeah, absolutely.
Extra pulling power.
And you know, launch your the podcast from there. So we're in the new fancy joint.
Yeah. Maybe we get the new studio and everything all finished off. But yeah, not a lot going on. And we're back in again next weekend, aren't we?
We're back in, yes.
There's some weird twist of fate. And we'll be podcasting again. Maybe we'll get a physical guest in. Should we get Hitz in? Should we get Hitesh to come down?
Yeah, we can have a think, can't we? Yeah. Hitesh for sure.
Hitesh taught me photography. Local maybe we'll see if he'll come down and berate me. Yeah. Anyway, we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.